in England in 1970 for New Zealand, where he worked for 36 years on the parasites and diseases of marine and freshwater fish and shellfish for the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries. He also spent a year implementing movement controls on pearl oysters in Western Australia to prevent the spread of disease between farms. As a result, he became involved in national and international biosecurity issues with the OIE, FAO and NACA, and was advisor to the Chief Veterinary Officer of New Zealand on aquatic diseases and global biosecurity issues. With that, I would like to welcome Dr. Mike Hine.
Thank you very much for that. I have to go fairly fast in this presentation because I have a lot of slides to get through. I'm hoping that if there are any problems or things that aren't understood, we can deal with them during the panel discussion. Firstly, I'd like to thank the organizers and the sponsors of this meeting, and particularly the organizers for inviting me to give this presentation. The scope of this presentation is shown on the screen here. The Bangkok Declaration of 10 years ago had four parts which were relevant to aquatic animal health. They were part 311, which was actually the health itself, 313 genetics, 314 biotechnology, and 315 food safety. I will cover these, and you will see 311, 314, etc., on the slides, which tell you which part I am referring to. I would note also, however, that the term biosecurity is now wasn't used at the time of the Bangkok Declaration. It is now. There are two issues that have come up since the Bangkok Declaration, which I'll also discuss towards the end. One is invasive species being spread around the world by transport vectors, and climate change. What is biosecurity? The FAO definition of biosecurity is shown here. Basically, it is a system by which we try to limit and prevent disease. Biosecurity originated in the medical sense with the quarantine of people returning from the East back to Europe who were kept on board ships which flew yellow flags to indicate that somebody on board seemed to have a hemorrhagic fever. Later, as the veterinary profession developed, quarantine and surveillance were brought in under them, and as usual as last, when we came along with aquaculture, we've piggybacked on the back of these other disciplines. Biosecurity is a dynamic process. There are several aspects that interrelate, and it has to be remembered that basically you cannot necessarily forecast how the developments were going to go in the future. If you look at the slide on the wall, you'll see that there's an increasing volume of diversity in trade which is occurring. There are changing practices and climate change. There are more detection methods, better immunodiagnostics, and people are now traveling much more and products are being shipped much more than before. How do you deal with this? You deal with this by minimizing, preventing risk. Basically, risk analysis is the key to biosecurity. It basically is founded on the approach that prevention is the way to control animal disease rather than treatment. Prevention occurs if you can detect organisms or you can identify risk situations which, if they go ahead, might import diseases into a specific country. It involves several stages and is basically a process. Risk analysis is only as good as the data that goes into it, and in that respect, we do have a problem in the aquaculture field. Very few of the species that are cultured have been studied sufficiently for us to be able to do worthwhile risk analyses. There is this problem that's been mentioned already at this meeting of why do we culture so few species and why don't we get into the biodiversity and culture more species? The reason is that with a few species, we can have international trade because we can carry out import risk analyses. If we look at the development of biodiversity in the next few years, if we look at countries starting to culture species in those countries, then we're going to find that if anyone wants to export or move those species, there will not be enough information to carry out an IRA. So if you're going to look at new species, you've got to remember that research needs to be carried out to allow export of that product. It is a proactive process. We do not consider how to treat animals because often that is not an option. If you consider the absolutely difficult task of remedial action, you realize that basically nearly all the examples where parasites and diseases have been transported internationally, once the parasite or disease has been transported, it is almost impossible, usually, to eradicate it. If you have a thriving industry, like the salmon industry, for example, and you import a disease, a salmon disease, then you could lose the whole industry worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So there's a very important aspect to biosecurity. The problem that we identify most is what we call transboundary aquatic animal diseases. This is where diseases have been moved in the past because of lack of biosecurity, lack of import risk assessments. And it has been due to several factors, including the movement of animals for aquaculture. Also, the movement of animals for pest control. Gambusia, which is the mosquito fish, has been transported around the world on the belief that because it eats mosquitoes in its home territory, that it will go on eating mosquitoes in other countries. In most of the countries that have introduced it, it in fact eats other food and breeds very fast and displaces native species. So you have a pest, not a disease. You also have to take into account other things. We think of live animals, we're going to transport live animals, but dead animals could be dangerous as well. My last few years in New Zealand, I worked in the veterinary diagnostic lab, and we needed a positive control for white spot syndrome virus. So what I did is I went to the local supermarket, bought one uncooked prawn from Southeast Asia, took it back to the lab, and we had our positive control. In other words, dead product for sale on the market, actually contained the pathogen, a viable pathogen for an internationally notifiable disease. Another problem with movement of animals is that some infections cannot reliably be detected in apparently healthy animals, particularly if that particular pathogen is at very low levels. I'll come back to that later with regard to the shrimp industry. One of the biggest problems we have at the moment is we are trying to exert control in the aquaculture field to protect the people involved in that commerce. And at the same time we're trying to prevent the spread of disease, there is an activity, the ornamental fish trade, which is transporting up to 1 billion fish a year, of which there are about 4,000 freshwater species and 1,400 marine species, which are being transported without health certification. You cannot find out where they come from because they are often collected in the wild and then they're accumulated by people who go through a series of trade negotiations till they end up in a major exporting country like Malaysia or Singapore. There is now good evidence, despite previous protestations from that trade, that in fact diseases are being spread by ornamental fish. A good example is in Australia. There's a fish called Murray cod. When the Australians try to do some experimental aquaculture with Murray cod, the cod suffered epizootics. When they then looked for the cause, they found an iridivirus was the cause of the epizootics. and it was 99.5, more than 99.5% similar to an enterovirus in dwarf gouramis, which were imported into Australia. So this is a probable case of epizootics in aquaculture due to the ornamental fish trade. One of the problems there also with the ornamental fish is there's a lack of information. Basically, there's very few studies on most of those fish species, that mainly species that are in fact of no commercial use, and therefore there's never been the funding for people to carry out research to identify parasites or diseases. In 1997, I carried out an import risk analysis for the New Zealand government on the importation of ornamental fish. And we managed to do that by thinking a bit laterally and thinking, well, let's look at the genera and species of fish that are being transported. Let's look at their temperature requirements. Let's look at the salinity requirements. And therefore, let's just look at whether or not this particular species of fish could infect fish within New Zealand. The basic principle and assumption being that animals tend to go and infect other parasites, tend to infect other animals that are closely related rather than those that are distantly related. So we carried out the risk analysis and we pinpointed 12 scenarios which were high risk involving internationally notifiable diseases. So consequently, the list of permitted species has been reduced. The problem with biosecurity and disease control in the aquatic environment is the complexity of the situation. Basically, there is a massive range of operations carried out, and these can be from a single species culture, high intensity in facilities where if there is a disease outbreak, the facility can be disinfectant. It could be, on the other hand, pond culture, where you have earthen ponds, and if there's a disease outbreak, you cannot sterilize or reliably disinfect those ponds. There are freshwater scenarios in which you have a catchment, so you have some control over the water that's going through the farm, but equally there are sea cages, and in sea cages with seawater going through the currents, you have very much less control over the situation. One of the problems at the moment is we have these new developing technologies that we've been listening to for the last 2 days. Some of them have great potential perhaps for the future, but I'd like to know how, in a biosecurity sense, one can monitor subsurface farms. I'm sure we'll get around that somehow, but it seems to be a problem at the moment. Patrick Sorglas, yesterday morning, talked about polyculture. He talked about having different things going on in the farm. You have seaweed, you have fish, and you have other animals. This is, to me, a very exciting idea. I don't see how it can actually be carried out because of the information needed on all those different animals and plants means that it would be hard to establish a system for controlling disease. And I think when we're looking to the future, looking at, okay, what do we want to develop? We've got to think, well, how practically can we manage these new situations, these new aquaculture ventures? Boundary aquatic animal diseases have severe problems. As far as economics go, they can be, if farms suffer massive outbreaks, losses in production, income and employment can be big. Also, there are possible impacts on wild populations and biodiversity. One of the problems, of course, is escape of fishes from farms, but that's been discussed and covered quite adequately. For the person involved in biosecurity, for the veterinarian who wants to be able to control disease in a farming situation, the current situation is difficult. The reason for that, quite simply, is that although we do have some antibiotics, we don't have many marketable or marketing authorization products to use in farms. There are two basic things that we have to think about in this respect, and those are the control of viral diseases, and how do you do that if you have no medication, and the control of bacterial diseases, which brings me on to biotechnology. Since the Bangkok Declaration, immunodiagnostics have gone ahead to the extent where we now have tools that are being developed which look exciting for the future and for treatment of disease in farms. Lateral flow technology is rapid, it takes less than 10 minutes, it's very sensitive, you can do it on the pond side, it's cheap and easy to perform. And lateral flow technology has a great exciting future, I think, particularly with regard to shrimp culture. Molecular techniques also are being developed, which will allow better diagnostics. Multiplex PCR will allow the simultaneous screening of several different pathogens or diseases at the same time. Loop-mediated isothermal amplification, or LAMP, also has got a lot of potential, but it does need training of staff, so it's a bit of a drawback at the moment. Next, I come to GMOs, genetically modified organisms, which we've heard a lot about today. The GMOs have theoretically a very bright future in that successful transgenic animals can be disease-resistant, freeze-resistant, sterile. You can manipulate the animal by putting in certain genes. However, I would caution that I cannot see in my lifetime GMOs being adopted on a wide scale in aquaculture. There is such a negative public attitude that it would be very, very hard to go ahead with such things. At the moment, the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S. is actually considering whether to legalize a growth hormone gene being put from eel pout, a marine fish, into salmon so that the salmon will grow all the year round. If you happened to see the TV 2 days ago, you would have seen a vitriolic attack on that proposal by various people who are opposed to fish farming, not on any technical grounds, but emotional grounds. To give you an idea of some of the problems with GMOs, I'll just mention two examples in New Zealand. One is that there's a disease called bonamiosis in New Zealand, which occurs also in other countries, but which is highly pathogenic and it's internationally notifiable. We looked at how we could manage our fisheries and everything around this, and it was decided perhaps to genetically engineer an oyster that would be resistant to bonamia. One of the large pharmaceutical companies invested money, and after 3 or 4 years, they found that they could insert a gene from African clawed toads, Xenopus levis, into the oyster, and those oysters would not then be susceptible to bonamia. But none of this was published, and the GMO oysters were never, ever released because it was realized that nobody in the industry was interested in it because they could see all the negative impacts that would come from it, so it had to be abandoned. And to give you another example from France, where I live, from my local town, for example, if you go to the oyster farm outlets, you'll see signs saying, guaranteed no triploids. And the reason for that is that triploiding, as we heard in an earlier presentation, involves heat shocking or temperature shocking oyster sperm and eggs at the time of fertilization, which will result in some of the offspring having three sets of genes, so they're triploid rather than the normal diploid. And the corollary to that is that the other oysters only have one set of genes. And those that only have one set of genes die, leaving the triploids. The triploids grow fast, they put on more meat, and they're just what you'd think the industry wanted. But the French public regard that as genetically modified, and so they will not buy it. And so triploid oysters do not occur at all on the market. A lot of the arguments, when you're talking to some of the people involved, seem to be, as I think Dr. Olin said, faith-based beliefs. They are emotional beliefs, but the people involved don't really understand what the situation is. I'd like to quickly look at some of the possible benefits of biotechnology in relation to shrimp farming. At the moment, pond-sized strips and immunodiagnostic tests are being developed for shrimp farming. Carrier shrimps can be tested with LAMP plus electrophoresis. But another exciting thing to do with shrimp is vaccines. Now, I use that term in a non-vaccination sense. Basically, there are certain food additives that you can give to shrimp that seem to make them more resistant to infection. These include viral coat proteins and binding proteins, double-stranded RNA and egg yolk antibodies. All seem to protect shrimp from certain infections. However, we have no understanding, as been mentioned in other presentations, of how the immune systems of crustaceans and mollusks work. We don't really know how we can exploit those situations. We do know that certain non-specific factors are produced, like C-reactive protein and heat shock proteins and superoxide dismutase, but we don't really understand how immunity works. You will have also heard in one of the earlier presentations that Danius venomi is a success story, in that now there are SPF stocks available, and the production of venomi has increased considerably since the production of the SPF stocks. There are, however, two things to remember when looking at developing SPF stocks. One is that once you move those stocks from the place where they were bred and developed, they are no longer SPF, because you put them into other water bodies and they could have become infected. The other thing to remember with SPF is that you have a specific pathogen free, not pathogens. You do not know. You have bred your shrimp to be resistant to a specific disease. However, the evidence in shrimp farming right throughout Asia and in the Americas is that shrimps are normally co-infected or multi-infected by different viruses. So you may have an SPF shrimp, and you might think, right, this is great. But a lot of shrimp can have viruses that are lethal, which do not, for a reason not understood, but they do not become apparent. They could be carried. How the carrier state works is unknown, but there are now many examples of where disease has been moved from one country to another because of these hidden infections, viral infections, which only became revealed later on. Another part of the Bangkok Declaration, 315, covers food safety. At the moment, food safety is an issue that's developing very, very rapidly in the West, certainly in the West, because people are now starting to become very aware of additives to foods and use of chemicals and other things. We have very, very few products available to us to control disease. One of the reasons for this is that to have marketing authority, you need to have two things. One is a determination of maximum residual levels of the agent in the flesh, and you also have to know the withdrawal time, how long after you've treated the animal before you can market it. The problem is that there is no uniform, at the moment, consensus and criteria onto what are the maximum residual levels, and as far as the withdrawal times go, there is no consensus on what tests need to be done to determine that. So at the moment, we are in a situation where chemotherapeutants, which we would like to be available, they are not available. At the moment, I gather that the situation is changing fast and that, in fact, these will become more available in the future. But at the moment, we have this problem. Antimicrobials have also the problem that people think, right, if you're going to put lots of drugs into a fish farm, you're going to get resistance, and that resistance is going to transfer to other bacteria and even maybe affect human health. This has been examined in great detail, and at this moment, there is no evidence whatsoever of resistance by bacteria or any effect on human health. Vaccination is sometimes seen as another thing that you can use instead of antimicrobials. Why don't we just go and get all our fish when they're small and young, vaccinate them against various diseases, and everything will be right? The problems are that whereas extracellular bacteria, gram-negative bacteria, such as furunculosis, edwardsiellosis, all the enterobacterial infections, whereas there are vaccines against them, there are very, very few vaccines available for viral diseases. And certainly at the moment, only infectious salmon anemia and infectious pancreatic necrosis can be partially protected against. But the vaccination is not regarded as being sufficient not as good as we would like. Also, another problem here is the problem that in fish farms you have often thousands, hundreds of thousands of fish. How do you vaccinate them? You can't realistically inject each one with a vaccine, so you have to use oral immersion, oral immunization in food, or immersion in water, so that the vaccine is taken up through the gills and through the mucous membranes. The problem is that small fish often do not have sufficient ability to produce antibodies, so these techniques are not very good. The other thing is that when you try to increase the strength or the effect of your vaccine, you use things called adjuvants. And adjuvants are things like oils and things like this, which make the reaction to the vaccine stronger. The problem there is often a lesion develops around the site where you've vaccinated the fish. And that is being seen more and more as an animal welfare issue. One of the other problems in food safety is human health. We all know that eating raw fish can cause human disease, human infection. Europe, for example, with roll mops, which are eaten, raw herring, Japan, which eats a lot of raw fish, have problems with a nematode called Anisakis, which infects the stomach. And it's interesting that in Japan, stomach cancer is one of the highest rated cancers in the country. I think it's actually the highest level of cancer is with stomach cancer. And it's thought, although not proven yet, that the roundworm in the stomach, along with soy sauce and other sauces like that, could result in the development of cancer. However, the example that we're showing today is basically that of foodborne trematode infections which people acquire by eating raw fish in Vietnam and other parts of Asia. And we're lucky to have here today the experts on that field. Raw fish is not eaten widely, but when eaten, there's a high level of infection could result. Of course, cooking gets rid of that. It kills the parasites. If you have products that do have parasites, if you freeze them to minus 20, then it kills the parasites and they can be exported. So these foodborne epizootics, they are zoonotic infections derived from parasites in raw fish. The other aspect of food safety and disease is contamination with organisms like Salmonella, processing problems with things like Listeria, and these also have received quite a lot of attention by the scientific community. Not in the Bangkok Declaration is invasive species. Invasive species are those that we've all heard about, water hyacinth, zebra mussels, organisms that have been moved from one continent to another or one country to another, which in the new country have no controls on their proliferation and which take over and cause very large amounts of environmental damage. And there are now many, many cases of that. When you look at the vectors, how are these things being transported? As far as aquaculture is concerned, the water, the big problem is shipping. Shipping transports ballast water, and also ships have hull fouling, that is, organisms living on the hulls. When they move from one continent to another, one country to another, they tie up at wharfs, and there, basically, will be or can be other organisms, similar organisms, which then can become infected with disease, for example. So it's not just with shipping a matter of moving organisms around, it's also a matter of moving diseases around. And there's good evidence now that diseases are also being moved by shipping. For example, the parasite Bonamia, which occurs in New Zealand and Australia, which is an OIE-listed parasite, it also occurs in Morehead City Bay on the east coast of the US, but only at the wharfs. If you go anywhere else, you won't find it. It's only in the wharfs. If you go to San Antonio West in Argentina, you will find Bonamia, again, the same Bonamia. And if you go to Vigo in Spain also, I was in Argentina in October, And I went to the beds where the first epizootics occurred, and those beds were 60 metres from a wharf, a bunkering wharf, where international shipping ties up to refuel. And once the epizootic started, it started in the beds near the wharf and then spread to other parts of the bay and around there. Genetic analysis of the Argentinian Benamia and the one from Spain, Vigo, showed them to be exactly the same. Vigo is a big fishing port, and fishing vessels from Vigo go down to the Southern Ocean to catch a fish called Patagonian toothfish, and they rebunker at that wharf. So we have only circumstantial evidence, but this suggests that, in fact, in this case, shipping is moving animals around and also diseases. Another thing that hasn't been recognized, but which is serious, is oil rigs. Everyone now looks at shipping, but oil rigs are important as they have large amounts of biofouling. They have mussels, they have barnacles, encrusting organisms like that. How are we going? Late? Okay. Okay, climate change is also not in the Bangkok Declaration, but there is also evidence now that climate change is affecting the disease status of aquatic organisms. A good example, again, is from France, where I live, where there is a herpes virus that is integrated into the cupped oyster, Crassostra gigas. And in that scenario, we've had 90% losses to the oyster production this year, and those losses have been due to this herpes virus suddenly appearing. And experimental work suggests that a 1 degree change in temperature, warming, has in fact caused this virus, which is normally hidden within the oyster, to appear. And if you look at the bottom of this particular slide, you'll see lots of lines going around the world. Those are the routes by which this particular species of oyster has been moved, and now these herpes viruses are turning up in many countries, and they're now jumping hosts into scallops, into clams. So here we have a biosecurity issue to do with these things. I'll be very quickly now. Okay, global efforts. There is a big global effort going on with FAO, the OIE, and the World Health Organization to try to interface with each other, to try to look at how we can have systems of biosecurity that are integrated and how these have to be or can be applied right throughout the various industries. This idea is called One World, One Health, and it's a big movement for the future, and this is the way I think things are going to go. I won't spend any time on these. The World Trade Organization Sanitary Phytosanitary Agreement here, it shows that the OIE, FAO, and WHO are involved with that. There are various regulations from the OIE, SPS, which are obligatory and binding. If your country belongs to the OIE, then you have agreed to go by those obligatory standards. But there are also non-binding and voluntary codes that you can implement in your country. There's been regional progress in biosecurity since the last declaration. In Asia, there's been improved regional resources. There's harmonization. There's been a move that's very innovative, which is to look at the region's diseases, look at the diseases that are listed by the OIE, and say, can we have a regional list as well, please, which, of course, exists now. So the Tokyo office of the OIE basically has a regional list of Asian diseases, which have been identified as being important in that region. Similarly, at the moment, Latin America is looking at how can they do the same thing and have regional lists. Australia is an example of how we think biosecurity should be tackled, and that is basically it's a multifaceted initiative. There's a thing called Aquaplan, which is a national plan. The states and the federal government are integrated. They both have roles. Their roles are clearly defined. And Australia is a very good example of the sort of thing that we need to look at. It, for example, is involved with ornamental fish. It's involved with ballast water. It's got a nice wide spectrum of biosecurity issues. But other countries are doing great things. Malaysia now has a biosecurity division. Belize now has started implementing legislation. And there are now countries all over the world that are developing biosecurity legislation. Also, there are large numbers of professional societies now around the country and a large number of journals that are on aquatic diseases and aquatic parasites. In conclusion, biosecurity issues are a major concern. They will affect the productivity of aquaculture into the future. And I'm sure that as we manage to get a handle on one disease, new diseases will emerge. The way forward is basically to try and integrate things, to look at all these different things which we're identifying as being weaknesses and factors, and trying to work out how we deal with these biosecurity issues. And I just would like to finish by saying that biosecurity is not something that veterinarians do, not something scientists do, not something that policymakers do. It's something that everyone has to do. If you're going to have effective biosecurity, you've got to go right from the international trade level and competent authorities and veterinarians down to the farmer who's sitting in the farm with a disease problem. And they've got to, all of them, be trained. They've all got to know their roles. Anyway, these are the people who've given me all this information, which will be greatly expanded in the review. And this is Melba Reyntazo's feelings about why we need to get stuck in to prevention rather than treatment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, for educating us on the necessity of biosecurity in sustainable aquaculture. To continue on, I would like to call all the panel members. As you can see, this is a big group. Like to call Dr. Mohan, Dr. Ramesh Pereira, Dr. Robin Waddle, Dr. Dallas Gard, Dr. Jasper Coulson, and the FAO officers, Dr. Rohana Subasinghe, Dr. Idya Karunasagar, Dr. Devin Bartley, and Dr. Melba Reyntazo. Okay, as usual, now we invite reflections, ideas, of course, recommendations from the audience.
Okay. Thank you very much. I would like to point out that the people here on the stage are people who are experts in regional implementation strategies, such as Dr. Mohan here, people who are familiar with zoonotic diseases in Asia, for example, parasitic diseases like Dr. Dalsgaard, and also people who are very aware of the overall global problems, such as Dr. Reyntazo. And then we have at the other end over there Dr. Pereira, who is in fact Biosecurity Australia, who can answer any questions you like about how they're integrating their services and how they operate. Also, we're lucky to have in the audience Dr. Barry Hill, who is an OIE person. And if anyone wants to know the current relationships between the World Trade Organization, the sanitary phytosanitary agreement, and the OIE, I'm sure he could answer your questions.
Dominique Gauthier of Aquestor. Maybe I misunderstood, but I was very intrigued by a statement you made that there is no evidence of bacterial resistance development to antimicrobials. And because this is against observations from farmers, I think, and I understand it's one of the main arguments for limiting the use of antibiotics and antimicrobials. So could you please clarify that point?
Yes. As far as resistance and antimicrobials are concerned, there are problems in determining where resistance might come from. One of the problems with aquaculture is we culture animals in water. Water runs off land, and land has animals that are farmed and which may be treated by antimicrobial substances. What I was trying to say is that at the moment there is no hard evidence that resistance has appeared because of the use of antibiotics. What is important to stress, however, is that antibiotics are applied sensibly by veterinarians. There used to be big abuses where people managed to get hold of large quantities and didn't know what they were doing and would put them into their ponds as prophylaxis. But it's a very controlled situation. And as far as I'm aware, from Dr. Peter Smith from the University of Galway, who contributed in that situation, he assures me that there is no evidence of that resistance originating from aquaculture establishments.
Just maybe to add on that, I actually do think, I mean, the simple thing about antibiotics is you use them and resistance will develop because there will always be mutations in whatever bacterial populations will be present, and there will always be resistant development. Whether then that will emerge as a problem in terms of treating specific diseases or not is then a different question. I also do think there is substantial evidence to show that resistance develops and it may have an impact on human health. Now, I'm not referring to aquaculture, but if we look on what happened in Europe, in Europe when it comes to adding antibiotics as feed growth promoters, Europe banned that, and it started actually based on research coming out from Denmark, where I'm from, and it went through the whole Europe. So today growth promoters are banned in for animal husbandry feed for pigs and poultry and so. And the reason for that was that it was shown that resistant to these class of drugs that were used as growth promoters, that were some of the key drugs that we would like to treat human disease on. And actually aquaculture is in a situation today where, from a food safety standpoint of view, we're not really concerned as it is of today about what kind of resistances do we see in foods coming from aquaculture. But I tell you, it's just a matter of time where people will also start looking and being concerned about, well, does aquaculture produce foods that is safe, not just in terms of pathogens, but also where we have what we would call acceptable quality in terms of antimicrobial resistance, whether this is gene or bacteria.
Yes, when I mentioned that there have been abuses in the past, I was thinking specifically of an example from New Zealand when I was there, where ornamental trade people were putting chloramphenicol into their tanks as a prophylactic measure. When questioned as to why, they said that they heard that chloramphenicol killed bacteria, and they'd gone to the local vet club, and the vet had given them an open prescription for chloramphenicol. That is now reserved for eye infections, for other human infections. It's not used now in the veterinary field, and it's not used in aquaculture, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, just to add a comment on the resistance, I think many speakers have mentioned the fact that there's limited number of products available for treating fish diseases. And I think it's very important that people focus on good use of the products to minimize loss of efficacy. Because the key part of the availability of the medicines is that they are safe and proven to be safe for use in fish, which are then consumed by people. So to prove that in aquaculture is a very expensive business, a very time-consuming business, and therefore there's relatively few of them. So you must look after them by having good practice of using the products. And I think this is one of the big issues in using medicines in smaller types of farming environments where maybe there's less knowledge or less control of how the products are used. And protecting those products is very important for the future of producing of aquaculture products.
Ingvar Torgersen from Norway. I would just like to make a comment on your slide with regard to vaccination. I might misinterpret it a little bit because the way I heard you that there were some challenges with using vaccines in aquatic medicines. Our story is probably somewhat different. In the late 80s, we produced about 50,000 tons of Atlantic salmon, and we used 50,000 kilograms of antibiotics to treat bacterial diseases. 2009, we produced 900,000 tons of Atlantic salmon, and the amount of antibiotics used was about 600-700 kilograms. We believe that the main reason for that is that the fish are being vaccinated, and we also enforce quite strict disease preventive measures throughout the production chain. But vaccination has been a success with regard to the bacterial use, and I really can't see your slide showing that positive side of vaccination. Thank you.
Yes, your comments are well taken. The information that I presented was cut and pasted from contribution from Dr. Roar Gooding from the Norwegian Veterinary Institute, and I basically, from his contribution, concluded that gram-negative bacteria certainly are treatable by vaccination. Virus is very much less so, and small fish particularly are still a problem in terms of trying to get them immunized. So that's where we got our information from, and you'll see that in the thematic review when it's published. But by the way, I would say that I didn't mean to make it a negative thing. It was just trying to cover the field.
Good morning. This is I'm Sudarshan Swami from India. This is a question for Mike. A couple of questions, actually. This is on the SPF status that you mentioned just now. You had mentioned that once the animal leaves a country or the SPF facility, okay, it loses the SPF status. And my question to you today, we are operating an SPF facility in India whereby we import the P. monodon shrimp. Then what good is it to run an SPF program if the status is already lost once it leaves the facility? And how do you commercialize it? Because you can never commercialize it until and unless it leaves the SPF facility and comes into a multiplication center. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for that. SPF, as I said, basically are organisms that are selectively bred to be resistant or free of a specific pathogen. That is done in controlled situation, but if you then buy that SPF animal and you move it, say, to another country or whatever, it is no longer regarded as SPF organism. I'd like to just pass on to Dr. Rientazzo, who could probably explain that a bit better than me.
Literature that we have on hand, that once an SPF stock leaves the original facility, the health status is no longer SPF. It's considered health status. So when you move it from the original facility to a new facility, you have to do all over. You have to establish a disease health monitoring program. You have to do surveillance monitoring in order to ensure that it doesn't get any other disease. And what Dr. Mike Hine has explained, the SPF stocks is only for a particular disease, but in many cases, our host has multiple infections. So that's, and I think one of the, Mohan can correct me, one of the best example for this is the importation of Vanamate to Asia. It's supposed to be SPF, and it has carried with it Torres syndrome, which is originally only distributed in the Western Hemisphere. So what we are trying to say is when you do these actions, you have to always do it with precaution.
This is Deep Swar from Nepal. Thank you, Dr. Hine. It was very excellent presentation. But my simple, enthusiasm is to know about the transboundary disease. You mentioned about transboundary disease, but didn't explain about the disease which has come through the river system. As you know, the fish and bird, they don't respect the political boundary. So when all the river systems are connected, then all the pathogens could be carried through the fish to the next country and through the water system it goes to aquaculture also. It has been damaged quite a bit to the aquatic production and fish disease, enhanced the fish disease. Do you think how it could be solved, and how are there any suggestions for that?
I think the issue there might be the amount of pathogen that actually is carried in large volumes of water, whether they would make an infectious dose causing a subsequent disease. But your point is very well taken. I used to work for the West Australian government, and the Northern Territory had barramundi in a river called the Argyle River, which were known to be carriers of some serious diseases. Western Australia, which was downriver, the river flowed from Northern Territory into Western Australia, claimed complete freedom from those diseases. And When we actually looked, we did find exactly what you've said. In fact, the disease occurred right throughout the river system. How you can control that, I really don't know. You know, it's a natural process. I don't know what sort of control can be exerted.
I think shared watersheds, it's always a tricky issue. So I think unless there is a integrated regional approach, as has been sort of proposed and implemented in many parts of the world, it's difficult to manage. So the only way out is an integrated approach for the shared watershed, so there can be a common early warning systems, common surveillance programs, common harmonized approaches. That's the only way you can minimize the impact.
I'm Ram from AIT Bangkok. My comment. It's about transboundary movement of fish, aquaculture species. What I have found is many countries, especially developing countries, they are not very well equipped with the human resource, in terms of human resource, and also, you know, the equipments they don't have. So they have really difficulties. And also after introduction of species, how that species can impact on the environment, also local species. So can this committee come up with a strict, concrete maybe recommendations for those countries, and also how they can do that in the future so that they will have no problems? Thank you.
I'd like to refer that question to Dr. Mohan next to me, because he's been involved in capacity building in the Asian region. So I'll pass over to him.
I think it's, again, going back to the regional strategies and regional approaches, because if you look at the Asia region, if you and NACA together, they have established the technical guidelines for responsible movement, identifying a series of key elements, looking into the management of transboundary diseases, so covering diagnostics, capacity, everything. You know, so it's not easy. Different countries are at different stages of development, and if you sort of look, review the progress made in Asia-Pacific, now over the last 10, 15 years, we can see significant progress made in several countries with respect to diagnostics, capacity, surveillance, reporting, and also disease control. You know, maybe Melbourne.
Thank you. Again, there are some instruments and guidelines that are available to help countries make good decisions. The primary one probably is the ICES, the International Council for the Exploration of the Sea. They have guidelines on fish introductions, including GMOs and genetically improved strains. So these guidelines are very effective if they're followed, and it helps you make a good decision. And basically what they involve is having an advisory committee that can look at the potential impacts and risks of the introduction, and then have that advisory committee move, interact with the proposers or the fish farmers, and help them make their proposal better. So it should be looked at as an enabling mechanism and not as a hindrance. And then I should also say that I think a little bit of education to fish farmers is appropriate. In the spread of disease and in the adverse impacts from inappropriate introductions, it hasn't been the environment that's been affected most. It's been private industry and the fish farmers. Aquaculture is the number one reason for moving species beyond their natural distributions, the deliberate movement. Aquaculturists, if they don't follow these guidelines, they're putting themselves and their industry at risk. So a little bit of education and some self-responsibility would, I think, go a long way, especially when you follow these codes of practice like ICES has developed.
I'd just like to make the comment that a lot of the regulations, a lot of the guidelines, and a lot of the documents that have been produced over the years look at basic systems that seem, if they're implemented, to be a solution to various problems. One of the concepts that is involved in that is zoning. This is where you have zones where diseases do not exist or where they do exist, and you have things called compartments within zones. And these have been discussed at great length. If you, however, look at the at NACA, if you look at Asia, for example, zoning has been a concept that's very hard to apply. Now, last time I was involved with zoning, it was with Melba in Rome. And at that meeting, you know, we were sort of trying to work out, you know, how do we make this actually happen? How do we zone? And, okay, it's easy in some countries because they've just got a bit of seaboard or whatever, and they're a small country. But if you look at the structure of Indonesia and the Philippines, how many thousands of islands are there in those two countries? If you then look at the fact that there is no enforcement which would, in fact, constrain movements, and the fact that every day thousands of boats move from one place to another, it's all very well to say, okay, let's bring in zoning. But I think in the future, one of the challenges is going to be, how do you control those sorts of movements between countries where there is no enforcement? And again, another example is in Japan and Hainan. There's been a lot of movement between them, and there's some evidence of disease movement between them.
Hi, I'm John Field with the United States. Next week, the COFI Subcommittee on Aquaculture will be talking about biosecurity. They have a paper that's been prepared. Be interested in the panel's thoughts, Rohana's, others, about what FAO can bring to this discussion, what the Subcommittee on Aquaculture can bring to the biosecurity discussion.
Thank you, John. Some of you probably don't know what the Subcommittee on Aquaculture is in the audience. The Subcommittee of Aquaculture, if you could remember the second keynote address by Mr. Jansan, he mentioned that it's one of the turning points of aquaculture is the development of an establishment of Subcommittee on Aquaculture for Committee on Fisheries for FAO. Subcommittee on Aquaculture is the only global intergovernmental forum which discusses aquaculture matters in government terms. So it's a very strong intergovernmental forum. For the first time next week, it's the fifth session, we'll discuss biosecurity, aquatic biosecurity as an agenda item in global sense. What the discussion would focus on is the importance of aquatic biosecurity, looking at biosecurity in a more holistic approach, going beyond health. All these years we've been talking about health, but then we are moving forward from health to incorporate invasive species, food safety, all the other aspects into one more holistic approach of biosecurity, as you have seen from this presentation. And we are discussing with the governments what the status of biosecurity in the governments and how we move forward. So that's what John's question, but that, of course, is a more intergovernmental discussion which will happen next year. As far as FAO is concerned, FAO is, over the past 10 years, FAO's focus on different aspects like food safety, animal health, has been now brought into one biosecurity program, where aquatic animal biosecurity also built into that overall biosecurity program for agriculture, which incorporates fisheries and also in aquaculture. So our program, where Melba is basically taking charge of the biosecurity part, we look at in transboundary health, transboundary diseases, invasive species, and also within our group, food safety aspects, everything in a more holistic manner. I think we are giving a new impetus to a number of areas within a new, more holistic approach. Thank you. If that answered your question, John.
Yeah, a small comment to follow up from what Rana said. As you know, FAO responds to requests from member countries. And what FAO would like to bring to this discussion is, well, perhaps we could bring a recommendation from this group that might recommend developing guidelines or better adherence to existing instruments. If this session would like to make a recommendation like that, I think that would be very useful. The other thing that we can do is talk to the delegates who will be there next week and get them from the floor to request action from FAO. And then we would have to respond to that. So thanks for that question, John. And I
bring it back to you. Can you help us help you?
Do I see? Yeah, one at the back.
Yeah, it's Craig Browdy from the USA. My question relates to technology and disease control. If we were going to have some sort of a funding source that was willing to put forth a large amount of money for an interdisciplinary research project, could the members of the committee make a recommendation on what the major goal in terms of a technology development to help control disease spread in aquaculture or a significant disease problem? How would you formulate a large goal for a multidisciplinary research project? What would be the things that you would target where you think that progress could be made in a five-year period, for example?
Thanks, Craig, for that question. I'm probably not going to answer your question, but I would like, I guess, to make more of a comment for people who are thinking about answering that question. I think it's very important to think about, how many of you attended John Benzie's presentation this morning. He drew some comparisons with the development of terrestrial animal husbandry practices and plant crops and so forth, compared them to aquaculture development. A lot of the in terms of technology, we have been concentrating to a great extent, as far as biosecurity risk in the context of diseases are concerned, on particular pathogens. Most of the work that we do is related to particular pathogens as they emerge. I will put it to you that this is only a very small part of the risk that aquaculture faces and the aquatic environment faces, and putting all our eggs into that basket of specific pathogens is a folly. I think we really need to, in terms of stepping back one step from your question, really think about what the risks posed are. And as John Benzie was saying this morning, you know, you're looking at 76 species that are that contribute 99% of production. Now, that compared to a handful of terrestrial animal species that are farmed, and you can probably fill this room with the number of texts that are published about any one of those one species, like cattle or sheep. Compared to the 76 species of aquatic animals, there's hardly anything known. There's a handful of species that we know a lot about, but the rest of them practically nil about. So I think we really have to think in terms of developing technologies, or more importantly, developing policies and strategies, step outside of this sort of pathogen-centric approach to managing risks, and really look at practices, risk practices in a broader sense, and manage against those in the first instance, because we don't really have the time or the luxury of being able to tackle this from a disease-specific perspective, because it's already too late then.
Yeah, quite a challenging question, Craig. I think it's very unlikely that any single project could be devised, because it's so multidisciplinary, so split up in terms of approach. But I think the thing which could really help us to, or the groups are working on the specific elements to work in coercion or consortium, would be to make the standards of achievement unified. So having regulations, I mean, from our point of view, we're looking at medicine development, having uniform standards and the application of those standards around the world would be a major step forward. And picking up the previous speaker's comment, having the ability to transfer knowledge between fish species more easily and still meet those standards would also be a major benefit. Somewhat technically challenging, but certainly would help facilitate bringing at least the medication part of biosecurity more available to more countries, and particularly when we're talking about Asia being 90% of aquaculture, making with many, many species, making those standards unified and making the data available and applicable across species would be a major, major step forward.
Maybe one last question. before we... Okay.
I'm Jojo from Indonesia. I would like to raise one issue that in many countries, especially in developing countries, the political decision is contradictory with the biosecurity. Many decisions will push the production at any means, and this one is the one who create disease outbreak in any places. What is the role of the health division? The health division in some country is the one who should overcome the disease problem, not the one who can prevent the disease. So is there any possibility that this board of panel can make a suggestion to any countries that to monitor the biosecurity implementation in that country? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me try to answer part of it, and I'm also going to probably ask someone else to talk. I think perhaps some of these things also will be discussed next week, because you're basically talking about the governments and the governance aspects of aquatic animal health and biosecurity. There are monitoring procedures in place for aquatic animal health diseases. There are reporting procedures in place, internationally agreed procedures. And we have Dr. Barry Hill, Professor Barry Hill here, who is the president of the OIE's Aquatic Animal Health Commission. And unfortunately, Barry is not in the panel because he joined this group a bit late. But may I ask Barry for you to respond to that question, as well as to say 1 minute of the role of OIE in a global aquatic animal health.
Wow, to answer that in 1 minute, the role of OIE. OIE sets the standards that are the only standards for preventing, or rather reducing the risk of international spread of disease with animals and animal products. Those standards are the only ones currently recognized by the World Trade Organization. If you apply the OIE standards, you're fully compliant with the SPS agreement. That's fact. Those standards have been agreed by all 176 member countries of OIE. They're global. They set the standards for international trade, the health standards, the health safeguards for international trade in aquatic animals and aquatic animal products. They're all in the Aquatic Animal Health Code. So, you know, there isn't really much need to invent anything else. It's already there, whether it is to do with the actual live animals from one country to another, or within zones within a country, or between compartments within a country. All those standards are there. All the methods for testing for the diseases are written down and agreed. All the surveillance requirements or standards are all there and agreed. So everything mostly it's all being done already. A lot of the problem lies with countries not having the resources to actually do the work. And that's up to governments to be persuaded to provide those resources so that meaningful standards, and I emphasize the word meaningful, scientifically meaningful standards can be applied within their countries, rather than standards that don't have a great deal of scientific strength and therefore end up giving a misleading picture of the health status of the country or the prevalence of a particular disease. But all the diseases in the code are all agreed. There are criteria for deciding which diseases are covered by the OIE standards. It's all there, and it's free. All this information is freely available on the OIE website. So without continuing for much longer, Anna, I hope that meets your request for clarification.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I think that's a good statement to end with. And I think we have had a very exciting session, panel discussion, and on behalf of the organizing committee, I would like to thank all the speakers, the three speakers this morning, and all the panel members, and of course all the audience, all of you who have contributed so much for this session. Thank you.